Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. So keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch another X Squared Radio. I'm coming to you tonight live from Eastern Kentucky, the foothills of the Appalachians. Gorgeous part of the country. If you ever get a chance to come out here, make sure it's spring or late fall. Any other time, it's inhospitable for those people that are used to dry climates. Life springs at you spontaneously from all directions around here. If it's green, it means somebody didn't have time to mow it, because you have to beat the wilderness back with a stick out here. But it also makes a very strong life energy around people. That's why we like it. Tonight, we are going to open up the phone lines right from the get-go. Toll-free anywhere in the U.S., 877-876-5227. If you miss these numbers, we'll give them to you about every 20 minutes all night long. Toll-free in Canada, 888-815-9756. And anywhere on planet or off planet or inside the planet, if you can reach a cell phone tower, you can reach us, 530-876-3222. This is Late Night, BBS Radio Network. The solar, The solar wind tonight is almost 700 kilometers per second.
Brooks,
yes, sir.
You can hear me. Actually, I think you gave out the other schedule numbers. The late night has a lot more numbers.
A lot more numbers on late night.
Yeah.
Okay.
And there's, I think you gave out station one.
Uh-oh. That's why no one calls, because I gave out station one numbers. Go ahead and give me the numbers.
On station two, you want me here? I'll make it so everybody can hear me.
Okay.
All right. On station two, the numbers are...
Sorry about this, folks. We moved from Station 1 to Station 2 about 4 weeks ago, and the transition has been a little bumpy, but we're going to make it just fine. Those of you that are online looking at bbsradio.com or looking at xsquaredradio.com, you'll be able to see these numbers, but many people tune in on other affiliates, and they need us to say the phone numbers, so we'll give them to you here in just a second.
All right. The numbers are in the late night, toll-free in the U.S. It's 877-270-8714. Direct line is 530-413-4515. And the toll-free Canada number is 888-228-4494. And then there are several other direct lines.
All right, do they roll over from these numbers?
No, they're all separate.
All right. These three numbers will get us started. All right, my friend, we'll continue on. Thank you so much. All right, the reason that we're doing it this way tonight, we have had quite a bit of mail from people around the world that have said that they really enjoy the show, and we appreciate that. And we don't really call it a show around here. We call it a program. And they enjoy the guests that come on, but that I have not come on by myself and actually spoken to you one-on-one, just you and me, in quite some time, perhaps about a year. And some of you like that format, so I thought I would come on by myself tonight. So it's just you and me. If you want to call in, we can talk about just about anything you want to talk about. I do have some subject matter to impart to you. As I was saying, the solar wind is almost 700 kilometers per second. This is a pretty good stream of protons per square centimeter to the Earth, and it usually results in an aurora borealis, and such was the case last night, also tonight. So if you live in Alaska or up in the North Country, Greenland, Iceland, or the Nordic areas, you should be able to go out tonight and see an aurora borealis. Speaking of North Country, we will give you a little update on the Inner Earth Expedition. We spoke to some very well versed and accomplished scientists at Stanford University who are doing studies in such obscure things as Arctic ocean floor tectonics. Sounds like it might fit really well with our venture. We contacted them. They contacted us back, and there is some interest in joining the expedition. So it looks like the scientific end of our expedition is beginning to shape up. We'll definitely keep you posted on how that goes forward, but Stanford is one of the universities of interest for us. Now, in the news, I want to get right to this because it's really, really important. You know, on this program, we've been talking about hollow planets for, oh, perhaps about a year off and on. We've had great astronomers like Tom Van Flandern on here. We've had scientists operating the Mars Rover program, Dr. Jim Bell from Cornell University. Make sure to go back and listen to those programs and catch yourself up to date on some of the actual scientific hypothesis. In science, we usually raise a question we don't know the answer to, something we want to find the answer to. We form a hypothesis, which is a statement of a fact that we want to prove or disprove. We decide whether we're going to try to prove it or try to disprove it, and design our methodology for doing so. We're going to do it by direct observation. We're going to do it by intuition or induction or deduction. And then we begin to design the experiments for accomplishing this. As we form these hypotheses about hollow planets, it is very difficult for us to actually perform the experiments because we are not in the habit of sending people to other planets to actually make these measurements. We have to go off of data that we collect. And unfortunately, it's very expensive to go out into space and collect this data. Right now, there are 67 active NASA projects in space, 67 of them. And each of them have their own funding. Each of them have their own grant writers that go to Washington and petition Congress for funding to be able to go and do these experiments. I'm sure each one of these groups of scientists, whether they're young or old, experienced or inexperienced, go to Washington with all the proper paperwork filled out and give their impassioned case. And about 99 times out of 100, they come home with nothing. But one time out of 100, they get the funding, especially if there is a military application to it. Can we see something a little better? Can we prevent an attack a little better? Are there military ramifications for it? Then, of course, grant money flows like as fast as they can run the printing presses in Washington. Some of them, though, don't really have military applications. They're kind of out there. They're kind of fringe, sort of like the snail darter preventing the construction of a hydroelectric dam. But in the case of Mars, it's one of those areas of exploration that's of almost no use here on Earth. I know many of you would disagree with that, but from a congressional point of view, we look at Mars exploration as something nigh unto Kennedy's space race in 1969. We will set foot on the moon by the end of this decade kind of speech. Very inspirational, but nevertheless, there were still military ramifications to that. Many of the things learned in the space program were directly tied to owning space. It was understood even then, as it is now, he who owns space owns the Earth. And right now, it is the free countries of the world, France, Germany, the U.S., England, and now Russia that owns space. So thus, we own the Earth. Nothing can move on the surface of the planet without some kind of space communication, whether it's GPS, cell phone, satellite TV, satellite telephone, or voice over digital telephone. It's all done through space research, courtesy of the great Hughes Satellite Company that began putting those satellites into space 2.5 decades ago. Now, here's the news story and why it has such tremendous impact. This is dated September 21st, 2007, 3 days ago. 3 days ago, this story came out. It broke on NASA News, and for some reason, I have not seen it on the mainstream press. I have not seen it emblazoned on the headlines of USA Today. This is something that's so amazing, so powerful. It's something that we talked about on this program many times over the last 18 months. We wrote it in two of our books, and the speculations are without end, almost infinite. They will get your imagination going, and that's what we're here to do tonight. This is the news story, and we're going to talk about the ramifications of this news story that ran in NASA News for the next 45 minutes. All the phone lines are open. Let me give those out again. In the U.S., it's 877-270-8714. In the Canada, it's 888-228-4494. And anywhere else, on planet, off planet, or cell phone, 530-413-4575. All those are good numbers for getting in here at BBS Radio Late Night, and you can listen and you can participate in history. Here we go. NASA's Mars Odyssey spacecraft has discovered entrances to 7 possible caves on the slopes of a Martian volcano. The find is fueling interest in potential underground habitats and sparking searches for caverns elsewhere on the red planet. Now, folks, those are the first two sentences of this news story. Now, I am not talking about mammoth cave openings. I'm not talking about a natural water-eroded, wind-eroded hole that sits at the bottom of what used to be an ancient river or a waterfall. We're not talking about anything like that. Now, there are pictures available. We'll post them on our website at x2-radio.com, and we'll let you look at these. These are fairly high resolution, although very high altitude. Here's the description. Very dark. Nearly circular features ranging in diameter from about 328 to 820 feet. Puzzled researchers who found them in images taken by NASA's Mars Odyssey and Mars Global Surveyor orbiters. Using Mars Odyssey's infrared camera to check the daytime and nighttime temperatures of the circles, scientists concluded that they could be windows into underground spaces. Now, folks, I am reading this directly from the NASA News article. I am not pontificating at all on this. This is word for word straight out of the news. I don't know if you know the ramifications of this, but circular holes in the ground do not exist in nature. If a bird pokes its beak down in the ground to find an ant or an insect of some kind or a seed, that's one thing. If a rock falls from space and strikes the ground and creates a crater, it might create a round crater if it hits exactly perpendicular to the core of that planet. The odds of a round shape forming in nature are almost infinite. The odds against something like that forming are almost infinite. These holes are definitely considering the shapes of the terrain around these holes. These holes are as artificial as if you took a laser and bored them in the planet yourself. Now, there's more to the article. Evidence that the holes may be openings to cavernous spaces comes from the temperature differences detected from infrared images taken in the afternoon versus the pre-dawn morning. From day to night, temperatures of the holes change only about one-third as much as the change in temperature of surrounding ground surface. Now, I don't know if you know much about pyrometry. This is the method of measuring temperature by infrared reflection. But pyrometry is extremely accurate, down to a tenth of a degree Fahrenheit, of telling the difference between two different temperatures. Now, there is a possibility the temperature might not be absolute. That is to say, if it says it's 183 degrees below zero, it might not be 183 degrees below zero. There is such a thing as emissivity. This is the degree with which that particular color of ground or compound reflects light. The only way to check that exactly is to put it in the lab and check it and to build a calibration curve. They don't have a calibration curve, so it might not be exactly 183 degrees below zero. But for pyrometry to tell the relative difference between two bodies standing next to one another, say a hot rock on cold ground, that difference can be detected within a tenth of a degree. So what they're doing, now keep in mind that the Mars Odyssey is not geosynchronous. That is to say, it doesn't hang over one piece of real estate on Mars. This is an orbiter. It goes around the planet in orbit. It makes about 23 orbits every 24 hours. So it doesn't get very long to look at these particular areas. Not only that, it doesn't pass over the same real estate every single time. As the planet rotates and as the satellite goes around the planet, it gets a look at a different piece of real estate each time. Sort of like a little ant running around an orange. It doesn't run around the same line of the orange every single time. It picks a different straight line each time. So it creates kind of a spiral effect, like winding string around the ball until it's completely wound. You don't get a flat plane of string, you get a ball of string, because the string is going around and around and around, different latitude and longitude each time. So for Odyssey to get back to this particular area, to take a picture of this area, it had to have been caught, and it had to have been adjusted so that these holes were in the center of these pictures. On the website, we'll show you six pictures that were taken. They were taken at different altitudes or different areas of zoom. They can probably zoom the lenses in, or they can digitally zoom them. Now, interestingly enough, there are seven of these holes, and they are calling them the Seven Sisters, seven dark openings into cavernous spaces on the slopes of a volcano which we call Arcea Mons. Researchers have nicknamed the features Dana, Chloe, Wendy, Annie, Abby, Nikki, and Jean. Interestingly, Seven Sisters also corresponds with the Seven Sisters of the Pleiades. Very interesting that they would have picked Seven Sisters. Don't know if the stars of the Pleiades go by those names, but it's interesting that they would have chosen those code names. And I'm making no statement whatsoever on the gender of the researchers that picked up on the data. So what we're looking at are relative differences between these holes and the surface around them. As Odyssey began looking at the ground, they could see that the holes were warmer at night than the ground that's cold around them, and they were cooler during the day than the warm ground around them. So it's a cinch to say that those are holes in the ground and not merely dark spots on the ground. So, here's the quote. They are cooler than the surrounding surface in the day, warmer at night, said Glenn Cushing of the U.S. Geological Survey's astrological team and of Northern Arizona University, Flagstaff, Arizona. Continuing the quote, their thermal behavior is not as steady as large caves on Earth that often maintain a fairly constant temperature, but it is consistent with these being deep holes in the ground. Close quote. If you happen to make your way to central Kentucky, around Brownsville, Kentucky, you will get to go on tour at a government facility known as Mammoth Cave. It's kind of interesting. If you get there, it might be 95 degrees outside, and the humidity might be about 95.5%, thoroughly unbearable for somebody from Nevada or Arizona. You'll make a long walk down a paved sidewalk about 200 or 300 yards, and at the bottom of this walk, you will enter a cave opening. You'll notice right away, as you headed down there, continuously soaking through your cotton short sleeve t-shirt, that as you enter the doorway, it's 55 degrees. It stays 55 degrees the whole time you're down there. You don't realize how good that 55 degrees feels until about an hour and 20 minutes later when you walk out the other side back into the opening and it's 95 degrees, 95% humidity outside. Quite a different story, and it's that way year round, 55 degrees beneath the surface of the earth. Unbeknownst to many people who have not been there, the deepest section of Mammoth Cave is only 360 feet. That's it. It does not go to the center of the earth. Those people that read the book Edda Dorfa, where the author walked into Mammoth Cave and ended up in the center of the earth, largely a myth. In order to walk into the center of the earth from Mammoth Cave, you would have to walk about 1,300 miles. Many people have tried to walk that far without food or water. It doesn't work. There are tunnels down in Ecuador that are so long, the Ecuadorian army has tried to go in these tunnels. They have taken a 7-day supply of food and water. They went as far as they could go and had to come back lest they should die. There was no hope of reaching an oasis deep inside this tunnel. They could only go so far before they had to turn and come back. Human beings are not made to go that long without food or water. And evidently it does not lend itself to going in there with motorized vehicles. You would think that to be able to go in with ATVs and cover, you know, 15 or 20 miles in a single hour, but such is not the case. All right, let's get back to these openings and what they mean. These openings ostensibly go straight down. That is, they go right down into the center of Mars. We don't really know how deep they are. We have not rolled the rovers over to them yet to look down inside of them. The rovers are many, many, many miles away from this particular location. So we're not going to get on-site viewing of this. I'll let that sink in for just a second. You remember at the top of the article where it talked about how they were sort of scrambling with this new data. What are we going to do? Now, I must tell you that the folks at NASA, especially the ones that work on these more obscure or even the more aged programs, are probably grad students. I don't know if you know any grad students or if you are a grad student, but grad students live on just a little less than the average lab rat. They have less to eat and less money than the average lab rat. So the reason that grad students work on projects like these is A, it's a great resume builder. It builds that CV like nothing else. It's extremely exciting to work on the cutting edge of exploration, just as we do here at X Squared Radio. And believe me, in the next week, we are going to try to get somebody from the Odyssey program to come on X Squared Radio. If you're out there listening and you're involved with the Odyssey program, I'm going to give out these phone numbers one more time. And again and again, and I want you to call in. Let's talk about this. Toll free in the U.S., 877-270-8714. Toll free in Canada, 888-228-4494. And anywhere else on the planet, you can do this in the U.S. too. Don't worry about it. If you got free long distance, you don't even need a toll free number. Call in. Let's talk about it. 530-413-4493. 4575. Now let's talk about the science of what this means, and we'll go through this logically, and we'll see if you come to the same exciting conclusion that I did. First of all, we need to know some facts about the planet Mars. Mars has no magnetosphere. For those of you that don't know what a magnetosphere is, it is a magnetic magnetic field that's generated around a planet, usually having a north and south pole, like our planet does. The flux seems to flow out of the north, go up, around, continuously, unbroken, all the way to the south pole, and then re-enters the core. This magnetic field is generated by a differential in rotation between two metals, usually iron and nickel, could be aluminum and titanium, could be copper, but it is not molten. Those of you geologists out there who think they know how magnetic fields are generated out of molten goo in the center of the planet, it's not done that way. It is done by a counter-rotation between the crust and the core. Now, there is some argument as to whether the crust floats on top of a molten sea that's in between the core and the crust, or whether, due to expansion of the planet from paleological expansion of the planet, that is to say, once the planet formed out of an accretion disk, that's a large dinner plate of dust swirling around a central point, as that dust coagulates into a small point in the center, enough to form a planet, it spins faster and faster and faster. A little law we call conservation of momentum. Looks a little bit like an ice skater. When she's skating, she goes into a spin and she pulls her arms in and thus spins so fast she looks like she's going to explode on camera. That's called conservation of momentum. There is so much energy in the system, you are reducing the diameter, which increases the spin. Planets do exactly the same thing as they shrink from dust disks into solid balls. Now, the problem is that as they form as solid balls, once they reach a certain mass, a different kind of physics takes over. Newtonian physics says that as mass coagulates in one spot, gravity increases. If that's the case, then planets cannot form as solid balls, they must form as crusted spheres. In any case, as it cools, it's spinning faster and faster, it begins to expand. Centrifugal force causes it to expand. The crust becomes unstable, it begins to crack, it fills in with molten material, and it continues its expansion. There are three conditions. One, the entire thing can fly apart and form a asteroid belt. It can become completely unstable and unbalanced and come apart and have to reform all over again. Two, it can spit off a part of itself. Either heavy metals make their way to the outside or becomes unbalanced or unstable, much like a big ball of wet clay spinning around and around, and all of a sudden a big ball flings off the side and goes splatting up against the wall of your nice clean apartment. Only instead of going out like that, it goes out and forms a moon and revolves around that planet for a while. We have evidence of that in our own solar system. Mercury was once a moon of Venus. It was spit off of Venus exactly like I just told you. Venus reached an overspin condition, launched its moon out into its orbit. The moon was so large that it broke away from the gravitational pull of Venus and formed its own orbit around the sun. Hence, we have Venus and we have Mercury. And then the third condition is the planet just simply cracks and expands and forms a nice, fairly smooth ball, and it begins to slow down and it begins to cool. And if it's got enough of the right elements in the right proportion, it forms a planet that looks much like ours. It reaches the right diameter, the right temperature, the right distance from the sun, and as I will make the claim, life forms, not only on this planet, but pretty much on all planets. We will find life on all planets in some form or another. Where there is space to have life, there will be life. It might not be like we recognize it. It might be microbial. It might be insectoid. It might be reptilian. But life will evolve. It will arrive from distant parts of the universe and will populate and proliferate in that particular environment. If you look at the human being, just as a little aside, it doesn't take much of an observation to see it is impossible for us to have evolved here. We don't have enough body hair. We don't have enough protection in our own eyes to protect us against ultraviolet light. We would have been a blind race a long, long time ago because our eyesight would never last in the ultraviolet rays of the sun. We don't have enough bone structure to withstand this kind of gravity for very long. We don't have a digestive system that can handle the life forms that are on this planet without some kind of preparation. We're not meant to eat raw food and raw meat. We don't have the enzymes in our system to handle it like a dog or other carnivores. We have to have a certain amount of preparation for our foods. We don't withstand disease very easily. Our skin is very frail. Our teeth are not made for the kind of work that needs to be done in surviving an evolutionary process. Evolution, the very thought of evolution, is that each random improvement in the genetic code gives that being some kind of survivability, a superior aspect of survivability. It gives it an advantage over its neighbors so that it continually survives at a better and better rate. And there is a concept known as irreducible complexity, which means that only subtle changes are not enough. A little change to form something like a human eye is not nearly enough. One has to have the entire human eye in order for it to function and to provide a survivability advantage. The digestive system, same thing. The brain, same thing. You don't make incremental changes and improve the survivability. If you don't improve the survivability, then you don't improve the odds that that trait will survive. And if it doesn't provide an advantage, all you do is improve the odds that that particular evolved state will go extinct and those traits will not be used in the subsequent generation. So, Mars has no magnetosphere. That means that Mars' surface cannot protect itself against the ultraviolet rays coming from the sun. Now, Mars is a little bit further away from the sun than the Earth, and it's a little bit smaller than the Earth, so it doesn't have as much gravity. Hence, it's not able to support as dense an atmosphere as the Earth. But it does support an atmosphere nonetheless. The problem is that with a sterile surface of a planet, you cannot support microbial life. If you can't support microbial life, this is one-celled animals and plants, then you can't support more complex life. Ultraviolet light kills algae. Ultraviolet light kills bacteria. Without these two very simple life forms, that and yeasts, you're not going to have more complex life forms on the surface of Mars. It means that Mars, if it's going to survive, going to host life, it's going to have to do it beneath the surface. Mars' surface is sterile due to the direct exposure to light waves in the shorter wavelengths. We're talking down around 320, 325 nanometers. Energy at that wavelength will dimerize organic material. That means that it will go into areas, unsaturated areas of the molecules, that is to say areas where double bonds exist or where complex bonds with oxygen or nitrogen exist, and it will cleave them in two like an axe splitting a frozen log. Once it cleaves in two, life ends. It forms a free radical, and that free radical usually destroys organic tissue. So UVC, or UV light in the very short wavelengths, is not good for life. It takes it apart like a daisy smack with a nine iron. All right, let's go a little bit forward. Nikola Tesla, in the late 19th century, received a 7-minute light signal from Mars. Now, a lot of people don't know that, but Tesla made note of it in his notes. It so influenced him, it so affected him, that he constructed a device which he mounted on top of Pike's Peak to broadcast a reply to Mars. Now, many of the people that funded Tesla and were enamored by Tesla's genius, and as the movie The Prestige made clear, Tesla once said that you're only allowed to be a genius once in a lifetime. After that, the people become uncomfortable. They have to get comfortable with one stroke of genius, and it takes a generation to do that, and then it's time for another genius to come along. So this message apparently was from survivors on Mars who were forced to move to the interior of Mars in order to survive. That's true. This is what he said, that the message that he received from Mars was from a contingent of survivors on Mars. And they said that their planet underwent a very bad cataclysm, that its atmosphere was sheared off by some very catastrophic cosmic event. And once that occurred, people had to move underground or they had to leave. And so they were aware that a contingent from their planet was transferred to Earth centuries ago because it was the next closest planet that could support life. There was no technology for a return to Mars for the rest of the people, and they remain waiting. Now, there's some interesting things to consider here. Let's just go through a little bit of logic. There, I am sure, is some excitement in this team that is at NASA. Maybe they're young, maybe they're grad students, maybe they're busily writing grants as we speak. As you know, the 21st was Thursday, and now it's the 24th, it's Sunday, and people are scrambling. They're at NASA, I'm sure, right now, sitting up Sunday night going, oh my gosh, who's going to drive up to Washington to make this proposal? We need to get to Mars in a big way. We got to get a rover. We got to get a tripod. This thing's 820 feet across. What if we could set up a cable and go down inside? There might be life. There might be water. There might be different temperatures down there. Who knows how deep this thing goes? It might go 10,000 feet deep. We just don't know. There are lots and lots of questions. Lots of questions. And believe me, tomorrow morning we're going to be calling the Odyssey team and following up on this article. We're going to find out more about this, and we're going to bring more of it to you. So each program that NASA has an expected lifespan. They go to Congress with these detailed forms filled out in triplicate. We need $6.7 million to build this gizmo, and we're going to put it in this widget, and then we're going to encase it, and we're going to launch it with a French rocket up into orbit that's going to go up to Mars. It's going to arrive next June, and it's going to run around on Mars, and we need enough funding for, well, the six of us, no little red Corvettes included, to last for about 18 months. And, well, by then I'll graduate, and I won't need a grant anymore. Anyway, the bottom line is that each of these programs has an expected lifespan. Once that is reached, the funding is cut back to make room for new programs, especially if there's only a limited checkbook, a limited amount of public interest, and maybe limited military applications. Each of those things have a definite effect on whether these programs continue or not. Jim Bell at Cornell University runs the Mars rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, and he does not have an explanation other than typical over-engineering as to why the rovers are lasting so long. You remember, if you've been watching the news, that Mars has been having a terrible sandstorm for the last 3 weeks. Just horrible. We're talking a couple hundred mile an hour winds. We're talking sand that's able to eat flesh from the bone in a matter of minutes. But somehow, the little rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, Once the winds died down and the skies cleared, evidently with no one going out and wiping the little solar cells off, the batteries charged right back up again, and Little Spirit and Opportunity are making their way toward the next crater. Quite interesting that these little machines last so much longer than they have been designed. I know the folks at Cornell University have to make phone calls every now and then just to make sure payroll is reached. And you know the communication problems that they have. I say problems. I don't really mean problems. I mean challenges. Here's what it's like. The folks at Cornell University develop a plan. We want to get, let's say we want to get Opportunity Rover, another 300 or 400 yards down the road, and we want to have a look at this ravine. Well, Opportunity moves quite slowly. It's not going to move 300 or 400 yards in one day. This has to be planned out over a series of days. You can't just turn the engines on and run it all the way over there because you'll run the batteries down, and when the nighttime comes, there's not enough power to warm the electronics, and the unit is destroyed. You can only use so much electricity. Then you have to wait for the next solar day to charge up the batteries, and then you can move again. So most of the moving is done late in the afternoon or early in the evening, and then it rests until the next day and charges up and does something again. Now, the communication back and forth is also quite challenging and frustrating. Let me tell you, if you think dial-up is slow, you would die running the rovers. You have to send your little digital message, probably in BASIC, out to the Mars orbiter. The Mars orbiter, called the Marsis, it has to catch that signal, and then it has to get around on the side of the planet where the rover is, send the signal to the rover. The rover will perform the action, and then go into a state of rest, and then Marsis will come around and receive the signal from the rover that it has performed what it has been asked to do successfully. The Marsis then gets all back around on the side of the planet where the Earth is, sends a signal back to Earth. The signal arrives to Earth that the orbiter has arrived where they said that they needed it to be, and they have the next message crafted, and they send it, and it goes to Marsis, and it starts all over again. So it is a system of a relay system. A little more complicated than two cans and a string to get those rovers to get to the location. It's painstakingly slow, and it takes several hours for the communications to go each way. The rovers do not have enough power to send a signal directly to Earth. Not possible. It has to be boosted by the orbiter. It also doesn't have the ability to receive signals directly from Earth. It oftentimes is not on the same side of the planet as Earth, so it couldn't receive a signal from Earth, even if it could receive a signal. It has to go to the orbiter. So that's the way communication to that little unit goes. Nevertheless, it is plodding along, granule by granule, gathering its information and sending a wealth of data back to Earth. Frankly, it's become a little boring looking at the pictures coming back from Spirit and Opportunity. Some people have made a lot of hay out of the digital pictures coming back, but the next series of rovers are going to have cameras that are a million times more capable as the ones on those rovers. And I think there are some places where we're planning to go on Mars. Cydonia is certainly one. The area where the glass tubes have been viewed from space is another. These are areas where straight lines have been viewed, which don't really appear in nature. Rings of structure, of support have been viewed. Shadows from those, reflections from those have been viewed. So maybe we'll send something a little closer in to get a little more first-hand view of that. Now let's get back to these holes. First of all, I did tell you that round shapes do not exist in nature. Almost impossible for round shapes to exist in nature. Elliptical, yes. Maybe jagged, yes. Maybe sloped, of course. Not round and not perpendicular to the surface. There's more. There's more to this. All right. A report of this discovery by Cushing and his co-authors was published online recently by the journal Geophysics Research letters. I quote, "Whether these are just deep vertical shafts or openings into spacious caverns, they are entries into the subsurface of Mars," said co-author Tim Titus of the U.S. Geological Survey in Flagstaff. He goes on, "Somewhere on Mars, caves might provide a protected niche for past or current life, or shelter for humans in the future," close quote. The discovered holes, dubbed Seven Sisters, are at some of the highest altitudes on the planet, on a volcano named Arcia Mons, near Mars's tallest mountain. Now, here's the peculiar thing. This quote goes on. "These are at such extreme altitude, they are poor candidates, either for use as human habitation or for having microbial life," Cushing said. "Even if life has ever existed on Mars, it may not have migrated to this height," close quote. The article goes on, though. "The point is that these vents may have been bored with lasers to extreme depths in order to make high-altitude vents far above the Martian dust storms. They may also have accessed snow caps and supplied fresh water to the dwellings below." Now, I don't know if you know the import of this. Why would somebody put perfectly round vent holes high up in the highest altitudes in Mars, above the Martian dust storms, and probably where the deepest snows would have fallen many years ago? Now, there's more to this, because as it appears from the data, these openings happen to be in a straight line. The new report proposes that the deep holes on Arcia Mons probably formed as underground stresses around the volcano cause spreading and faults that open spaces beneath the surface. Some of the holes are in line with strings of bowl-shaped pits where surface material has apparently collapsed to fill the gap created by a linear fault. Some of us have been involved in drilling for oil in this country, and there are a variety of methods for exploring for that oil, one of which is called a Landsat survey. This is a land satellite survey of the Earth from space. It helps people find the fault lines, find the fissures in the ground, and they map these to intersection points, which are highly likely points of openings deep beneath the Earth that may or may not fill with oil. They drill at these junctions and try to tap into oil. It is a wildcat procedure that is only successful about 1 in 20 times. However, once a wildcat well is found, it's pretty easy to step off from it 400 feet or 500 feet and drill another well, and then another, and then another. And if you know anything about how domestic oil is explored, paid for, drilled, and distributed, you'll understand why that happens. It's quite the economic engine on all sides, and a source of great tax benefits. But one of the things about fault lines is they don't really exist in straight lines. Now, there are shears that happen. This is where an earthquake might happen, and the earth might slip or crack. But the cracks are straight only for a very short distance, maybe a quarter of a mile, maybe a mile. These tunnels, these holes in the surface of Mars go on quite some distance, maybe more than 100 miles. The thing about it is, straight lines don't exist in nature. The linear fault may be a linear tunnel that stretches for hundreds of miles in a line beneath the Martian surface. It is extremely unlikely that any structure exists in straight lines in nature. It is more likely that seismic activity may have collapsed tunnels that were built beneath the surface of Mars for subsurface civilizations. How much more likely is a matter of speculation, but the odds are significantly better than the assumption by observers that no intelligent life ever lived on or in Mars. Now, one might say that it is irresponsible or perhaps even deceptive to say that straight tunnels had to have been built by technology and not by nature. But let's discuss the point. Let's use some logic here, okay? Mars either once had intelligent life or it did not, right? It either did or it didn't. That's logical. It's a nice binary decision. It is within the realm of possibilities that Mars once had a viable atmosphere and that something happened to it. Whether it was sheared off by the close pass of a planet or a gravity wave that passed through the solar system, it could have been there. It could have had an atmosphere. The fracture lines of some great planetary stress are visible on the surface of Mars, even from Earth, with powerful telescopes. The surface may not have been cold, or it may have been really cold, but it may have been habitable. You know, they say that it's impossible to live in the Nordic areas or the Arctic areas of our planet, and yet polar bears, penguins, and even Eskimos seem to survive just fine in those areas. Cold does not necessarily mean inhabitable. Now, once the protective atmosphere was gone, life on the surface became impossible. Add to that the fact that Mars has no magnetosphere to protect it from the sun's UVC, and you have a setting for surface sterility. Now, that leaves only three choices. First, we made a binary assumption that life did exist on Mars. We think of it logically. It either did or it didn't. But if it did, where did it go? We only have three choices. The life left the planet for another planet. It went beneath the surface and hopes for a rescue, or it went extinct. Life, if it survived this way, under the surface, may have been far more primitive than previously enjoyed on that planet. Now, let me just extrapolate a little bit on this, and then we'll take a short break. We have a fairly technologically advanced planet. Since 1996, we've had a World Wide Web, which has opened up a library, the most amazing interactive library of knowledge to the people of Earth. This has been marvelous, not just for children, but for children as old as me. And we've been able to tap into the Internet and learn things at a phenomenal rate. And intelligent people who have the ability to learn far, far faster than teachers could feed information to a young person or to an old person like me. We tend to gain and assimilate this knowledge at a phenomenal rate. So we are becoming a very technologically advanced planet. Our technology is now doubling every 2 years. That rate may increase, but if it doubles every 2 years, within 30 years, we won't even recognize the technology that we have now. We'll think of things like internet and cell phones and actually doing surgery to cure cancer as ancient as something as rubbing two sticks together to get fire. But if we had a cataclysm, the size and scope of which might be similar to that which Mars went through, something that cleaved off our atmosphere, took sea level and jacked it to about 10,000 feet, took the temperature and dropped it by 60 or 70 degrees, wiped out our computers, took our planes out of the sky, took our glass and steel skyscrapers and etched them right down to the grass, took our advanced plant life, trees and woods, jungles, our rainforests, and dried them out like a prune in the noonday sun, then things would be a little different. Just because you know how to fly in an airplane doesn't mean you know how to build one. Just because you might know how to fly an airplane, how to operate one, doesn't mean you know how to mine aluminum and form it into aircraft grade, and make copper wire, and build the telemetry by hand. You see, all the little technologies that we take for granted, that we delegate the specialists all around the world to the Taiwanese, to the Russians, to the English, to the people in California, to the people in Ireland that write the software. We take all of that for granted, all the way down to the simplest things as glass windows for our house, fiberglass insulation, gasoline for our automobiles, the little chip that goes into our cell phone. We take all of that for granted. But all that technology would be lost. I don't know if you've done camping before, and there are some gadgets that you can take with you camping, but in about 3 or 4 days, most people get tired of camping. Try it for about 30 or 40 years and see how technologically advanced you are. See how you're able to explain to your children how you once rode on an 80-horsepower motorcycle in the wind, how you used to use a jet ski on the open water, or how you used to scuba dive, or how you used to draw blueprints on a computer and then have exact measurements that you could give to somebody and they could go build you a steel structure. Try to explain that to a child that's never seen it, and then have him remember it enough to be able to carry it on to the next generation. In one or two generations, we'll be as technologically advanced as somebody hunting for blackberries on a Saturday afternoon at the turn of the 18th century. You don't seem to realize that we were on horseback farming with mules 120 years ago. That was as technologically advanced as we could get. All of this has only been realized in the last three generations. Three generations. In the next hour, we're going to talk about maybe why that technological advances have been made in the last three generations. Let me just top this off. The observations of this incredible set of precision openings on Mars have prompted researchers using Mars Odyssey and NASA's newer Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter to examine the Seven Sisters. The goal is to find other openings to underground spaces at lower elevations that are more accessible to future missions to Mars. The Jet Propulsion Laboratory manages Mars Odyssey and Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter for the NASA Science Mission Directorate, Washington. Arizona State University operates the Mars Odyssey's Thermal Emission Imaging System. For additional information about Mars Odyssey and the new findings, visit the Odyssey Mission homepage. You can count on us here at X Squared Radio. Our researchers will be all over this tomorrow morning, and next Sunday we'll bring you an update on the Mars Odyssey mission and what they're going to find. As we close out this hour, let me give you the numbers one more time. In the U.S., toll-free, 877-270-8714. Anywhere toll-free in Canada, 888-228-4494. Anywhere else on the planet, and of course you can use these numbers in the U.S. and Canada. If you have free long distance, it's not a problem. The number is 530-413-4515. 413-4515. Give us a call. All right, we will take about a 1.5 minute break with our commercials, and we'll be right back with more X Squared Radio.
Brooks Agnew here with X Squared Radio. If you like wildlife art and would love to add some of the most beautiful replicas to your home or office, you should visit Wildlife Gifts at X Squared Radio. They have everything from pandas to fish to eagles to horses in all sizes and price ranges. No matter what animal you love, they have the art for you. So visit Wildlife Gifts at X Squared Radio for that special someone today.
You know we have revealed to you the ancient predictions that natural disasters are going to increase in power and frequency in these times. We might not always have the National Weather Service or the Emergency Broadcasting Service. So you might want to get your hands on some of the best weather reporting instruments around. Visit Wind and Weather at X Squared Radio and pick up something that might be useful. They also have the neatest gifts for your favorite people who like things for the outdoors or for their meditation garden. Check out Wind and Weather at X Squared Radio.
This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio. Did you know that 11 of the 12 sets of footprints on the moon were made by Eagle Scouts? It's true. Soon, men and women will be doing the real moonwalk. But just so we don't forget, the first footprint on the moon has been replicated in a limited edition plaque that would make the perfect gift for a court of honor. Maybe you need something special for your office or your library at home. This high-quality plaque can add that something special that lets people know how excited you are. We are returning to the moon. Visit Countdown Creations at X Squared Radio today and order your limited edition First Step on the Moon plaque.
And welcome back to more of X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. Sorry, I don't have a cough button tonight, so may cough in the telephone, but that's okay. I'm just getting over something. Just wanted to let you know that I am human. I know, it's a little disappointing, but it's true. We're coming to you live from extreme eastern Kentucky, right here at the foothills of the Appalachians. Very amazing place to live in this country. Wanted to let you know about a couple of our affiliates. One of them is called NitroPack. Many of you have already visited NitroPack, and you have taken advantage of the great items that they have there. NitroPack, we searched for a long time, almost a year, to find an affiliate that could provide you with supplies for emergency preparedness. This is a very important thing. Now, I don't think that you need to go out and get yourself a 5-year supply of food and water. I don't think you need to build yourself a shelter in the ground. I would advise moving away from the coast, but that's just me. If you should happen to look out your window one day and see a 400 or 500 meter tsunami, why don't you grab that 72-hour kit and come visit us over here in eastern Kentucky, where you'll be safe on the other side of the mountains. Anyway, please go to NitroPack, check out their 72-hour kits. These have everything you need to keep yourself going for 3 days. Many people out there, and there are many organizations out there, who are pushing the idea of storing a 2-year supply of food. It sounds good. It is a good plan. I don't have any problem with it, except that as a scientist, I think about the logistics of owning a 2-year supply of food, what it means on several levels. First of all, I'll be able to go down to my basement, and I'll be able to get a full course meal 3 times a day for everybody in my family. Well, that sounds wonderful. That sounds wonderful. If we have a cataclysm like an earthquake or a hurricane or a tsunami or a tornado, or if the power company goes out of business or the trucks stop rolling and all the grocery stores are wiped clean, it sounds like you might be able to feed your family for a while. Here are the logistical problems with that. If you are living in a neighborhood, let's say you're living in a large apartment complex, or you're in a condo on the 18th floor in downtown Manhattan and you have a 2-year supply of food in your apartment. The problem is that when everybody else runs out of food and they're starting to get down to a size 4 and you're still plunking along in a nice comfortable size 8, they're going to notice that you're well fed and they're not. Now you might say, we're going to stand out a little bit. Maybe we should pack up all this food, put it in our SUV, and let's see if we can't head over to Eastern Kentucky. Well, the problem is that once you load about 2,500 pounds, and that's dehydrated weight, of food into an SUV, and you happen to make your way through traffic with other people who don't have a 2-year supply of food, well, I don't need to go any further with that. You get the idea. Am I preaching fear? No. What I'm trying to do is get you to think things through. Go out and buy yourself a 2-year supply of food, put it in your basement. If you have your own farm, or you live up in the mountains somewhere, or you live out in the country a little bit where no one's going to really pay attention to you. But if you live in downtown wherever, in a big city, it doesn't make a lot of sense to have a 2-year supply of food in your house. You're just going to make yourself a target, and you're never going to be able to use it. You're not going to be able to move it, and you're not going to be able to use it. So, be smart. Put your 2-year supply of food somewhere where you can use it. If you got a friend that's got a farm out of town, put it out there. If you have a storage building way outside of town somewhere that's secure, put it out there where you can get yourself out of town. Get yourself to your food supply, away from everyone, and then take it where you need to take it. Bury it somewhere. Find a vault somewhere. Put it out there. Then you can do it that way. So, just trying to get you to use a little common sense. Go to the people at NitroPack. Just click on the NitroPack affiliate banner at x2-radio.com. Pick yourself up a 72-hour kit. They're small. They fit inside of a backpack, and you'll have a 3-day supply of food. You can walk, ride a bike, catch a ride, hitchhike, whatever you got to do to get to where you need to be, to get to family. Buy one for your kids at college, so they can get themselves from where they're at college back to the house. Smart idea. The other thing that I want you to get to is 123 Inkjets. And we use this affiliate. They've been with us since day one. Everybody out there has an inkjet printer. I have one. Everybody I know has an inkjet printer. The problem is when you go down to that national superstore to buy cartridges for that thing, you're going to spend about $80 between the black and the color cartridges. That's just too much money, folks. If you go to x2-radio.com and click on the 123 Inkjets banner, you will go to a website that is probably the largest seller of inkjet cartridges in the country. HP, Lexmark, it doesn't matter. They've got it all. Black, color, they've got the original equipment, they've got refills, anything that you want. Now here's the difference. The difference is price and delivery. We're talking $15 for a black cartridge and free shipping. You get it in 2 days anywhere in the country. It goes right in your printer without any problem, and you spent about 1/3 to 1/4 what you'll spend in the stores. And here's another good thing. This time of year, 123 Inkjets, every time you make a purchase, you have a chance to win a new printer. Now, that's cool. This is a company that takes care of you. 123 Inkjets. Click on that banner at X Squared Radio. In the last 2 months, the folks down at Phoenix Science Foundation have been working diligently to bring you clean and renewable energy sources. Over the last year, they have researched all kinds of new energy technology. Many, many inventors have sent their ideas to us in various levels of development. However, out of all of those, very few I'm going to say less than three have actually sent us working prototypes. I know you're out there in your garages. I know you're out there in your attics and your basements. And your mind is going and your hands are going and you've got an idea. And you've got it to the benchtop stage. The hardest thing in the world is to follow that passion and create that prototype to get it to the point where you can get it into every consumer's hands. I know what you're going through. The knowledge for how to do this somehow is being poured out on the earth right now like never before. I don't know if it's coming in the form of prayers. I don't know if it's coming in the form of dreams or just pure energy out of the center of the galaxy or out of another dimension. I just don't know. But I can tell you, I've met literally hundreds of people around the country as we've toured, lecturing on the Inner Earth Expedition or on the books that we've written, and we've talked to folks who have an idea for some kind of new and renewable energy. We want to bring that new and renewable energy to market as badly as you do. We also know that it's very difficult to find the funding to be able to make that happen. We're doing our best to try to marry the two. No promises. We just want to make sure that we work together, that we love each other, that we think of the planet and not so much about the billions of dollars we could make. The money will come. I'm sure. You'll be fine. But many of us feel we do not have a lot of time left on this planet. That if we don't turn around our technological use of fossil fuels on this planet and start using some of the clean and renewable sources that we've thought of, some of the technology that we're developing right now to reduce the amount of gas we're using, to reduce the amount of electricity we're using, or even generate electricity, or even generate alternative fuels like hydrogen or like fuel cell technology, or like electric cars, or even biofuels. We want to bring all this technology. We think it all has a place. And you know what, folks? There's room enough for everything. And there's room enough for everyone and all their ideas. So, all I'm doing is encouraging you to go forward. Don't eat your young. Don't compete against each other so much. Help each other out. Work together. Government, maybe they have the money to loan you and maybe they don't. Banks, forget about it. Private investors, maybe. The money ultimately has to come from the consumer. If we're going to have clean and renewable energy in this world, it's going to have to come from people like you and me. We're going to have to decide if we're going to help or not. Many of us are taxed about as much as we want to be taxed. In fact, I don't know anybody that's really happy about paying more taxes. We want to pay as little as possible, but mostly for these two reasons. Number one, we kind of like to use our money for what we want to use it for, right? And number two, we're not very happy about what the government's using its money for, or should I say using our money for. That's the two reasons. That's the only two reasons why we really mind paying taxes and don't want to pay any more. But here's the bottom line. Somewhere along the line, the public has to realize that they have a responsibility to the planet. And they're going to have to find a way to come together. 350 million Americans, 475 million Europeans, 300 million Russians. There are a lot of free people out there in the world. And you know what? They can do anything they want with their money. They can go on a family vacation, they can save it, they can buy a house, or they can blow it all on a lottery ticket. Whatever you want to do. Whatever you want to do. So why not take a couple of dollars a month? Find one of these guys. Find a company. Find a nonprofit if that's what you need. Send them a couple dollars a month. Call it a voluntary tax. Call it a voluntary energy tax. And you know what? Don't worry so much about throwing the money down a rat hole, because it's really not going to happen. These guys are out there working their hearts out on their workbenches long after you got off your job and are sitting down watching another episode of Full House rerun. They're in their garages, they're in their attics, they're in their basements, sweating away, using their own money, their own time, and their own dreams to get these inventions ready. For who? For you. To put in your cars, to put in your houses, so that you don't have to burn coal, so you don't have to burn gasoline in your cars, so you don't have to use up 10 or 12 or 15 kilowatts a day to heat or cool your house. And some of them are even coming up with technology that has health benefits, things that reverse the effects of Parkinson's disease, clean up skin diseases such as psoriasis, get rid of cataracts, regrow hair, for crying out loud. There's all kinds of technologies out there. But you know what? Every single one of those people has been looking to the government for funding. They've been looking to private investors for funding. And they're not finding it, folks, because it's not there. The money is right there in your checkbook. So we're asking you, we're pleading with you down here at X Squared Radio. We're not soliciting for any one single one out there. I don't care if it's a nonprofit. I don't care if it's your neighborhood inventor. Find something. Find someone. If you can't find someone, write us. We'll find a list for you. These guys can use your help, even if it's $2 a month. But the nice thing about $2 a month, folks, if it comes from 2 million people a month, that's about $4 million a month that gets poured into new technology. Think about it. Think about it. Use your mind. $4 million or $40 million a month poured directly into new technologies of all kinds. And there's room for everyone. So we just want you to go by your heart. Use what you think is right. Realize that you have a responsibility to voluntarily pay, donate. Let's call it a new energy tax, if you want to call it that. But you know the nice thing about this tax? You get to choose where it goes. You get to choose how it's used. And even nicer, you get the benefit of sending that money out. So all I'm saying is put it aside. I promise you, you'll find a way to send it out. You'll find somebody out there that's needing it. And yeah, there's a little bit of buyer beware. I'm sorry to say, there are people out there who say they have inventions and don't. In fact, there are people out there that say they work with inventors and don't. But so what? If you send them $20 or $30 in a year, it's not going to hurt a thing. They might be able to buy a new little red Corvette or build a big house in the mountains on your money, and they just might do all that. But that kind of stuff comes with its own karma, so don't worry about it. Don't be a skeptic. Don't be a cynic. We need some money flowing in this general direction, and we don't have a lot of time. So that's my infomercial for the last 15 minutes. Now, this hour, we're going to talk about transdimensional travel. I know that's something you think about all the time. But here at X Squared Radio, we try to get to the bottom of a lot of these theories. Try to think about things and study things and bring them to you in a way to get you thinking. Because we know you're in your car driving across the frozen tundra out there, or you're sitting at your workstation on a Monday morning or a Tuesday morning. You're turning on X Squared Radio. You've tuned into BBS Radio Late Night. I know there are hundreds of you out there right now, sitting by your phone, sitting by your PC, and you're listening to this program. And I'm going to send out some phone numbers to you because I want you to pick up the phone and I want you to call in. Maybe some of you have never called in before. Don't be afraid. I promise. We're just sitting here over in the far eastern side of Kentucky at the foothills of the Appalachians, and we'd love to hear from you. Here are the numbers again, toll-free in the U.S., 877-270-8714. Now, if you have free long distance or you have a cell phone, You can call this number from anywhere on the planet and get through to us. It's 530-413-4515. 413-4515. Give us a call. We'll talk about anything you want to talk about tonight, but right now we're going to talk about transdimensional travel. You know, recently astronomers looking for planets have developed a better method than just looking for them through a space telescope. You know, most planets are outside our solar system, and they don't give off enough light to be seen from our neighborhood. So we use a theory called perturbation theory to reveal their whereabouts, and here's how it works. We can see extremely distant stars and star clusters, and we're getting better and better at it. Our Hubble telescope has brought us images that are just blowing us away. Many of them are being used in motion pictures because the resolution of these are just phenomenal. But you would not believe the telescope we're about to launch in space next year. The one we're going to launch in space next year has over 1 million times the resolution of Hubble. We're going to be able to see millions of times further into space. We're going to get faster data, much more clear pictures. We will learn more with the launch of this telescope than even Hubble has brought us. In fact, Hubble really only had one mission, and that was to age the universe for us. Well, it did that. It finished that mission, and then it was handed off to some more grad students, and it's still got some batteries left in it, and it's still got some capabilities. We've upgraded it from time to time. So we're still using it. But believe me, it's a jalopy compared to what's getting ready to be put into space. So while we're training our telescopes on a star, we can precisely measure the wobble of that star as the planet orbits it. It's sort of like you leaning back, pulling on a rope that you're spinning around and around. It has a lead weight in it. You're going to be perturbed by that lead weight, and so is a star. So, anyway, it looks like we have a caller on the line. Caller, can you tell us where you're calling from and your first name?
My first name is Em, and I'm calling from Northern California. And I'm
wow, great.
To talk to you. I think you might know who I am. I'm Ann Card.
Yep, this is Ann Card, yep. One of my good friends out in California. How are you, Ann?
I'm good. I've just been listening to you, and hearing about Mars, and I wonder if it's true that that surface was affected by Maldek when it exploded. Maldek was a planet in our solar system years and years ago, and according to what I've heard, it made Mars red, blew so much stuff onto it. But anyway, I believe the people live beneath the surface there, whoever they are.
Well,
I love you.
Would you like us to send a manned mission to Mars to look for the people beneath the surface?
Well, I'll tell you something. I've done a certain amount of mental projection, and I went there. And
uh-huh.
I was underneath the surface. Well, I was in a kind of a dome-like situation, and there was light and music without any apparent source. And I saw some people that I knew. And I will probably never forget it. I mean, it's just one of the things. I can't remember what I had for breakfast, but I remember that.
What did
anyway,
the people look like? Were there any people there on Mars?
Well, there were where I was. There were people.
What did they look
there
like?
Was a huge radio station there run by a man whose name is Corton, C-O-R-T-O-N. And he took me there. And I saw it. It was just very, very big with only a few people running it, but it was a huge station. And then it was time for me to come home. So I didn't see any more, but I knew the people I was with, but that could be all in my head. I don't know. Anyway,
wow.
I have been wanting to talk to you for a long time, and how's the deal for the North Pole coming?
Well, it's coming along. As you know, we took a pretty aggressive strategy for raising the money to go. This is not your average expedition. Just the cost
right.
of chartering the ship and getting everybody there and back and insurance and all that is about $2 million. Now that, by expedition standpoint, is a very, very expensive expedition. It may be the most expensive civilian expedition in history. So
right.
We also took the idea that most people don't go on expeditions like this, but they experience expeditions by watching TV or watching film.
Yeah.
So we thought if there's value in the film and the value in watching an expedition to someplace no one's ever gone before, then maybe we could find someone that would be interested in financing those films and thus finance the expedition. Well, that has
yeah.
been the case. And we
All
found
right.
a lot of interest, and we're working on it. And we, in fact, just Friday of this last week, we signed a global distribution deal for all of the films that we bring back. Now, that's a major, major
Boy.
Step.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I'm
that
very
means
happy
all the
to
Best
hear
Buys
that.
And Walmarts and all that will
yeah.
have access to the films that we produce.
Did you did you see that little blurb about the grandson of Admiral Byrd that gave his journal? Did you see that?
Yeah, I've read the journal. I've read what
yeah.
was
what
said
say?
To be his diary.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I've read it. I think it's a little bit possible that it's not Admiral Byrd's diary, that it
mm-hmm.
is a fabrication, and I'm not even sure that a relative of Admiral Byrd had anything to do with the diary.
Oh.
You can't really trust the things that you read on the Internet anymore. We
That's
do
right.
have a call out to try to get a family member of the Byrds to validate the diary, but
mm-hmm.
we haven't heard anything yet.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting. I want to believe. I really
yeah.
do.
Yeah. Well, I was with some people that are quite connected to Telos, you know, the subterranean city there under the Mount Shasta.
Yeah.
You know that one.
Yes, I do.
Well, I had a woman here at my house who was from there in the 80s, and she told me all about it, and it was very just real. In other words, what's being said now is what she told me then, and it was very real to me. I think she was telling me the truth. But we'll see. I mean, sounds lovely. It's how I would like to live. It's very symbiotic. Everything helping everything, which would be wonderful. Anyway, I have a date with you and your wife to have lunch sometime. Remember?
Yeah. I'm not really sure when we're going to be able to do that. I don't know when I'm going to be back up in the Mount Shasta area. It might be next spring. I don't know. We've got quite a busy schedule.
Yeah, I'm about 4 hours from there and 3 hours from San Francisco. So if you came to either place, I'd find you.
Well,
okay.
We'll see what we can do about setting that up. We definitely have to get back up that way. We've made way too many friends up
yeah.
in that area of Northern
yeah.
California to neglect them.
Yeah.
So we're going to make another trip
yeah.
back up there.
I was interested in your advice to get food. In 1970-something, we did that with through the Mormon people. They had that kind of food, you know, dried food stuff. And
uh-huh.
it's lost for about 25 years, and I've had it since then, and I decided to see if I could give it to somebody, and I gave a lot to a church so that they would distribute it because, hey, how much longer can I keep it and it be good? So I'll have to do some more now.
Yep, I understand that. I've had food storage quite a bit myself. Some of it I've used, some of it I've had to throw away, and some of it I gave
yeah.
away. But
yeah,
you know what
right.
they say about having food storage. It's better to have it and not need it than need it and not have it.
Not have it, that's for sure. Yeah. Well,
but,
I live in a very beautiful country area, you know, so I'm okay. Anyway, I'm very glad to finally talk to you, and I will let you go to someone else.
All right. Thank you so much, Ann, for calling in.
Yeah.
We love you.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, so we will continue with our conversation about trans-dimensional travel. Now, we were talking about perturbation theory and how we see the stars wobble. Well, the speed of the wobble and the amplitude, that is to say how far the stars pulled one way and then the other as the planet goes around it, are very good indications of the size and the weight of the planet. Some planets orbit nicely around the observed star or star cluster, but some do not. Some don't orbit at all, but are detected as what we call free-floating planets. That means they just float through space without an orbit. Either they broke away from the orbit of their star, or they were pulled out of their orbit by another free-floating planet that was going by, or their star fell apart. Maybe the star burned up, or it exploded or something, and the star and the planet broke free like a string breaking on a yo-yo. And the yo-yo went flying across the room and went through the window and out into the playground and down the streets and around the block and all the way to China, because there wouldn't be anything to stop it from going that far. So these planets, and it's estimated somewhere around 10 million of these planets are floating through our galaxy, they cause some havoc, and they sometimes even collide with other planets and other stars. Just a couple of years ago, we saw a very large comet strike Jupiter. We watched that come in, break apart into about a dozen different chunks, and it struck the planet Jupiter. That comet was discovered by an amateur. The name escapes me right at the moment, but I'll remember it in a couple minutes. And we watched it strike Jupiter. Made a rather large, 50 or 100 times the size of the biggest nuclear blast we've ever had on this planet. Made nice dark spots that went around the planet for a long time. We were able to observe that. And sometimes they collide with smaller planets. Some solar systems don't have a big vacuum cleaner like Jupiter in their solar system, and they manage to pass by and cause havoc on smaller planets. You heard Anne mention a planet called Marduk. Marduk, anciently described by Immanuel Velikovsky in his book Worlds in Collision, talks about Marduk, and Zacharias Sitchin talks about in his book a planet called Nibiru, which could very well be Marduk, traveling through the solar system and causing gravitational havoc as it passed through, collided with one planet named Tiamat and broke it apart. Some of that planet struck our planet, and then the rest of it passed very close to Mars, stripping its atmosphere off and perturbing its orbit severely, maybe even pulling it a few thousand miles further away from the sun, which makes it even colder. So these planets are far more dangerous than comets or asteroids. Depending on how long they've been thrown away from their sun, they may be a solid frozen ball of methane ice, or they may be a revolving planet much like Earth containing water and life forms. In any case, if the planet does not get a strong dose of excess radiation or collide with something deadly, there's a fair chance that life forms are preserved in some form on the planet, either frozen or in some form of stasis. Some of these planets may travel rather slowly, but some may have been launched by a supernova, accelerated by slingshot effects of near passes with other larger planets, and even encounters with supermassive spinning black holes. But all these bodies moving through space, and who's to say any body is fixed in space, warp the space-time fabric. These space-time bends are the pathway photons and radio waves travel as they effuse through the universe. If you take a laser light and you shoot it from Earth up at the stars, if it makes it through our atmosphere, it continues forever in a straight line. Those photons maintain their energy for a long, long, long time, and they head out into space in a straight line. Oh, wait, did I say straight line? I meant that they actually follow the threads of the fabric of space-time. So if that thread bends around a gravitational body like the sun or like the center of the galaxy or some large planet or star, the photon's going to follow that path. If the path's going to look perfectly straight to that photon, but it's relative to us or relative to everything else in the universe, it's not straight. It's curved, just like space curves. The light from distant stars may look straight from our perspective, but it likely has been twisted, stretched, and bent through countless gravitational fields, being the origin and the destination before it reaches the eyepiece of our telescope. Gravity is by far the weakest of all forces in the universe, so weak, in fact, that we've just about left out of Einstein's equations altogether. Now, Newton liked gravity, but Einstein didn't pay a lot of attention to gravity other than just to say that it curves space-time. He was more a quantum physicist. When it is included in the equations, we often get answers like infinity, which isn't very meaningful to we mathematicians. But there is one type of gravitational body that is theorized to pack enough punch to be interesting. I mean, really interesting. To really have an effect on the universe and cosmology. And that is the massive spinning black hole. It's unique. Small black holes, ranging from 2 to perhaps 100 times the mass of our sun, are supposed to be spherical, smooth, and spinning as fast as they possibly can spin. But black holes 10 million times the mass of our sun may display quite a different behavior. Black holes are termed such because the body's gravity is so powerful that light cannot escape outside a mathematical barrier called an event horizon. This is the point at which light travels, but then it turns around and heads back in, or it never even gets to that area. All photons that are generated, and keep in mind, photons are massless particles. They are still affected by gravity and cannot escape this point of no return. Anyway, there may only be stray X-rays and immensely powerful gravitational waves rippling out into space like a giant stone dropped into a smooth pond. Inside the event horizon is maximum chaos. In fact, solid mathematics says the chaos inside the horizon increases exponentially more than the actual increase in size each time it swallows another planet or a star or a moon. In other words, the surface area of the horizon may increase by, let's say, 1.15 times with a new collision, while the chaos inside the horizon increases 1.6 times. Well, conserving momentum, a black hole this size might revolve on its axis about 50 times each second. Now, that's a lot. That's fast. Our planet goes around our sun once every 365 and a quarter days. So that gives you an idea. Something that revolves 50 times a second, that's 50 or 100 times the diameter of our solar system, that is to say, the orbit of Pluto, you're talking something that's spinning very, very fast, very, very massive, and it is warping space-time like you cannot imagine. The resulting centrifugal forces are not enough to overcome the event horizon, that's impossible, but they are theorized by Einstein-Rosen and by Roy Kerr to be enough to change the shape of a black hole that large. Now, my theory, and I don't even really want to use the word my, let's just call it the theory of transdimensional travel, states that massive spinning black holes form these big mass-free voids. These are voids where there's really no matter, nothing to get in the way, and it induces transdimensional portals in space and time. Now, the real small ones can probably stay with a singularity in the center. This is a point at which all the mass of that black hole has been crammed into one pinhole, and it's generating all the gravity of that black hole. But these supermassive ones, it's virtually impossible to cram all that mass into one pinhole at the center. Instead, because it's spinning so fast and there's so much force generated, so much chaos on the inside of that event horizon, that if you apply the Heisenberg uncertainty principle about the actual location of that singularity in the middle, you won't be able to find it. You won't be able to nail down its speed and location. That means that the mass, the actual solids inside a black hole, are spinning like a hula hoop on the inside of that event horizon. Now, if you look at it like a giant hula hoop or like a big sombrero galaxy, what you see, if you look at it from the edge of the plate or the edge of this large flat accretion disk is you're going to see a straight line of solid mass warping spacetime, like two big tornadoes, one out the top and one out the bottom. We see a similar structure when you look at quasars. Quasars are the largest organized structures in the universe. We see light and particles accelerated to the speed of light popping out the top and bottom like the north and south pole of the Earth. Only these things go jetting off into space at close to the speed of light, and it looks like a star. There's so much power coming out of these things. Well, that's what you see when you look at it from the side. But when you look at it from the top, straight down the north pole of the event horizon, what you see is a giant window. Yes. A traveler moving through a wormhole like this, pulled between two dimensions, like two tornadoes joining at the small end, would age normally without the effects of tidal gravity. That means you wouldn't be stretched and squeezed the way our Earth is stretched and squeezed by the moon being so close to the Earth traveling through space. Every time the moon ends up on one side of our planet, it stretches and squeezes the planet and the oceans, and it causes our tides. Anyway, you won't be affected by that because all of the mass is going to be way, way out, many, many light years out toward the edge, and you're going to be in the middle, far away from that gravitational pull. So, the universe outside the wormhole would age billions of years in a few months compared to a traveler going down the middle of a black hole like that. A spacecraft or a planet would be able to safely travel from one distant point in the universe to another, or even from one universe to another universe in this manner. Moving between dimensions appears to require some harmonic matching to successfully negotiate without annihilation. In other words, when two sound waves come together that are in harmony, they strengthen one another, kind of like two notes on a piano or two notes on a guitar. This is called constructive interference. The sound is actually louder. It actually has more power, and it's pleasing to the ear. When they're outside or when they're out of phase or not equally divisible, exactly like music, they will destroy each other like a sour chord. Only matter or consciousness that vibrates at a suitable frequency can exist in that dimension. Inside each dimension, there are multiple universes, each with its own unique qualities. Now, matter can decay and move lower in vibration through an irrefutable law of entropy. That's energy moving from higher orders to lower orders, or something that's hot is cooling down, or it can lose protons and neutrons and move from higher order elements down to iron, which is very stable and very cool, atomically speaking, and it can last for a long, long time. It's said that if the universe were left alone, it would all end up being iron sooner or later, nice and cold, without any kind of heat, no creation going on, no light. It would just be cold iron balls everywhere. Well, in order for matter to move to higher states of order, or decrease in entropy, intelligent input must be applied. Usually that comes from supernovas or even from outside influence. No observation of matter or energy decreasing in entropy in nature has ever been observed. In other words, nature, unless you apply some kind of life force or intelligence, it doesn't become more complex. It becomes simpler. Okay? The only surface that's different than this is the surface area of a black hole compared to the decrease in order inside the event horizon. And this is just a relative difference. Like I said, when a planet gets sucked into a black hole, the chaos inside the black hole increases much more than the surface area of the black hole, and that does have the appearance of higher order. But it's only relative. It doesn't really mean that the surface of the black hole is becoming more intelligent spontaneously and by itself. So I don't want you to get confused. Yes, lower entropy does occur in nature, but only relative to other things. It doesn't mean an increase in intelligence. Well, what does this mean? It means that there is a way to move vast distances across space and time and dimensions. Have we tried it? Well, maybe, but not yet. I mean, we don't really have somebody coming on the program and telling us about it, but we can see the effects seeping through into our universe. Soon, we will be testing dimensional engines. If those tests prove successful, down at Sandia Labs, we should be able to travel to Mars in less than 3 hours. I'm going to give you a little quote here. This is an article published about by Sandia Labs about this dimensional motor. Here we go. It's called the hypothetical device. The hypothetical device, which has been outlined in principle, but is based on a controversial theory about the fabric of the universe, could potentially allow a spacecraft to travel to Mars in 3 hours and journey to a star 11 light years away in just 80 days, according to a report in today's New Scientist magazine. The theoretical engine works by creating an intense magnetic field that, according to ideas first developed by late scientist Burkhard Heim in the 1950s, would produce a gravitational field and result in thrust for a spacecraft. Also, if a large enough magnetic field were created, the craft would slip into a different dimension, where the speed of light is faster, allowing incredible speeds to be reached relative to our universe. Switching off the magnetic field would result in the engine reappearing in our current dimension. The U.S. Air Force has expressed interest in the idea, and scientists working for the American Department of Energy, which has a device known as the Z machine that could generate the kind of magnetic fields required to drive the engine. They say they may carry out a test if the theory withstands further scrutiny. And that's an article written by Ian Johnson, science correspondent for Scotsman magazine. So just to give you a, make sure that you know the sources for these, you can look them up yourself, or you can call us down here at X Squared Radio, toll free anywhere in the U.S., 877-270-8714. Anywhere else in the world, on planet or off planet, if you can reach a cell phone tower, you can get to us. That number is 530-413-4515. Give us a call. We'll talk about this. I don't know if you know the ramifications of a hypothetical device powered by the Air Force's Z machine, but here is a little story about it. Back in the 1940s, we were powering our aircraft with propellers. We generated, between 1,200 and 2,000 horsepower with diesel engines turning about 2,200 RPM. And sometimes we used water injection to get a little bit more horsepower out of them, much to the detriment of the engine. You could only inject water in them for a few seconds to get a little extra burst to get away from someone or catch up to someone. But we were basically rotating wings through the air to try to push our aircraft faster and faster. In 1943, the P-51 Mustang H, Model H, finally reached a level flying speed of 455 miles an hour. It was arguably the fastest propeller aircraft in the air. Now, the P-47 Thunderbolt, also known as the flying trash can, could dive at close to the speed of sound and pull out. And it had wings so powerful that it could actually pull out of the dive, although sometimes the pilots would pass out and crash the airplane. Later in the war, close to 1945, the Germans had developed the Messerschmitt ME-262, which was a jet engine aircraft. They didn't have a lot of fuel, and they couldn't carry a lot of ammo, but they could fly about 600 miles an hour, arguably faster than the P-51 Mustang. The P-51 Mustang, in a low dive, could achieve flight speeds of over 500 miles an hour, almost 550 miles an hour, if it really pushed it. So, and it was far more maneuverable than the ME-262. So the P-51 Mustang, although it could be outsped by the Messerschmitt, it could definitely outmaneuver the Messerschmitt, and so they were sort of one-on-one matches in the sky. It wasn't hard to cut off a turn of an ME-262 with a tighter turning Mustang and shoot it down. The bottom line is this. Here is the difference. The propeller engine was just basically flying through air, creating lift through a rotating wing, pushing the aircraft faster and faster. Fortunately, the Mustang had such low drag coefficients that it was able to fly almost as fast as the wing could push it through the sky. The problem is it was only working with air. And as trials were done to try to break the speed of sound, it was determined to be impossible. Until somebody figured out how to compress the atmosphere behind rotating fans in the front of an engine, a jet engine. They compressed the atmosphere, blew fuel into that compressed atmosphere, ignited it, and then funneled it out the back. Now we had a different condition. We had increased atmospheric pressure inside the chamber of the jet. We had fuel stoichiometrically mixed with that and blown out the back of the jet, and we were able to break the speed of sound. Of course, we had to learn a few things about surfaces and remembering to push the stick forward instead of pulling back. Now we have computers that help pilots break the speed of sound on a routine basis. Lots of photographs of that out there. And it's barely as catastrophic as breaking 60 miles an hour is on in a vehicle on the freeway. It's about that commonplace now. But what we had to learn to do was to compress the atmosphere, mix it with fuel, and blow it out the back of that turbofan or that turbothrust engine, and thus push the craft faster than the speed of sound. The sound barrier was broken. We left it behind 40 years ago. Now, here we are in the future, and we're limited by another barrier called the speed of light. Theoretically, we can't travel any faster than that. Einstein said mass would become infinity at that speed. But after all, what is the speed of light, and why is it constant? Okay, let's answer the first part of that question. The speed of light, since you haven't called in, at our toll-free number, 877-270-8714, or anywhere else on the planet at 530-413-4515, is 186,000 miles per second. That's the speed of light. It's supposed to be constant. We represent it as C in the equation E is equal to mc squared. But if you really think about the speed of light, it's a fraction, is it not? It's a distance over time. 186,000 miles is the distance, and the time is 1 second, right? Well, what did we say at the beginning of this hour? That gravity warps space-time? Gravity warps time. So if gravity changes time, then gravity also changes the speed of light. Ah, so the denominator in the speed of light fraction that we just talked about, the 1 second, is actually not the same everywhere. 1 second here isn't the same as 1 second on the moon. 1 second here isn't the same as it is in the space station. It's slightly different. The faster you travel, the more time changes. The more time changes, the more the speed of light changes. So the speed of light is not constant. Now, what needs to be done with these engines? And we're talking about the Z machine generating magnetic fields to do what? To create a different atmosphere for gravity. In essence, what they'll be doing is sucking gravity into the front of this engine, compressing it, remixing it with fuel, which would be a magnetic drive, and shoving it out the back end, thus breaking what we consider the speed of light barrier. We will move so far past the speed of light barrier that space will become navigable for us. the same as it is navigable for the craft that come here. So, the artificial induction of transdimensional gravitational fields will require great amounts of energy. But engineers have been able to successfully reverse engineer UFO technology to accomplish this already. The movement of planets intact requires a window exactly like the one proposed by this theory of transdimensional travel. The paradox is that if time travel has ever been mastered, even in the future, a million years from now, haven't those travelers already come here and fixed the mistakes we are about to make? Sounds interesting, doesn't it? Very interesting. In other words, if time travel has ever existed, ever, it exists right now. What better time to come back and make some kind of change that will keep the future from being catastrophic than right now? If I were them, and I was in the future, and I was studying history, and I were to say, what time could I go back to make a subtle change, to publish a book, to make a movie, to go on a radio program and tell the people about something? Where would I go to make that greatest effect? I think I'd go back to the year 2007. 2007 is about where the high school students that were just catching the front end of the internet wave are just coming out of college. About 2 years after their college graduation, the internet became feasible about 1997. It takes 8 years to go through 4 years of high school and 4 years of college. They're about 2 years into grad school. This is the time I would come. And now maybe you see why all of these inventions, all of these great ideas seem to be popping out from everywhere. We'll tell you a little bit more about that in our final hour here at X Squared Radio. The technology that we're going to discuss with you tonight, you may have heard of it before, some of it. I promise you it's real. I promise you it's coming. It's going to make a huge difference in the way we negotiate our planet and the way we live with our planet. We'll be back after a couple minutes of commercials. More with X Squared Radio after this.
Brooks Agnew here with X Squared Radio. You own an inkjet printer, right? I used to buy my inkjet cartridges at a national chain store that will remain unnamed for about $35 per cartridge. The color and black cartridges together ran around $80. Well, no more. I discovered a great place to buy printer supplies at 123 Inkjets. They not only provide excellent quality and fast shipping, every time I buy, I get a chance to win a free printer. Stop paying high prices. Visit 123 Inkjets at X Squared Radio today and start saving money.
Trust me, y'all, trust me when I tell you this is all hard.
things we have learned here at X Squared Radio from our emails is that many listeners to this program are educators and students. Well, we have recently added a great affiliate for you. The Academic Superstore is the place where you can buy software, neat tools and gadgets, and even supplies such as calculators and iPod peripherals at huge discounts. The best things for the classroom and for the student are just a tax-free click away. All you have to do is click the Academic Superstore sign at X Squared Radio and start saving. Brooks Agnew here with X Squared Radio. There is some place you should visit before the end of the week. The Horizon Project is probably the most important examination of future Earth events in the world today. But there is a reason you should visit their website soon. I can't give you all the details here, but I can tell you that the first DVD in the six-part series is now available for pre-purchase with a $5 discount. This series will no doubt be airing on the History Channel or Discovery Channel, but you need the uncut version with all of the bonus material. Trust me, it may be one of the most important video productions you will ever see. Click on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio today.
Welcome back, Earth Explorers, to our third and final hour of X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from eastern Kentucky, right up against the foothills of the Appalachians. Don't know if you've ever been out here before, but this is the, some people call it God's country. It's the place where things spontaneously leap out of the ground at you from all directions. And you have to beat it back with a lawnmower. If it's green, somebody forgot to mow it out here. It's a very fertile place. Place of beautiful people and great colleges and great football. Wanted to let you know that there is a new engine additive out there. It's called TVT. We're going to provide a link for you on our website at x2-radio.com. It is an oil additive that removes virtually all of the friction from your engine. It's been tested. I've tested it. I've met the inventor. It is for sale out there. Unfortunately, it's a company that can't afford a lot of marketing because it takes, as you know, tens of millions of dollars to market an engine additive to get it in places like AutoZone and Advance and Napa and all these auto parts stores. So it's only available online and through certain reps that are out there. So we're going to make it available to you. I can tell you this much. If you pour it in your engine wear is over. You also will have more fuel mileage, less problems with your engine. I've tested it in my engine. I have 312,000 miles on a V6 Dodge Dakota on the original engine. So trust me when I say that. We're also working on a new technology for gasoline engines called the pulse charge technology. We'll let you know a little bit more of that as the year goes on. We'll be entering in one of the annual races against some of the best car makers in the world and set another world record for you. I was going to talk about new technology in this hour, but while I was off the air, I had common sense come back to me, and I decided not to talk about the new technology. Did that for a number of reasons, a little bit of prudence, I guess, and trying to think of things to talk about tonight. Maybe I should not talk about things that are so speculative, at least with respect to those companies and those people trying to develop those technologies. As they get developed, we'll bring them to you. Trust me, you'll have first shot at being able to put them in your car or your home and gain the benefits from it. I also wanted to let you know that you can click on the Horizon Project link at X Squared Radio. As you know, about a year and a half ago, we got together with Brent Miller and the folks down at Intuitive Design. They financed and directed and wrote a film called The Horizon Project. This is a film about the upcoming possibility of a polar shift. So if you really like the Discovery Channel and you like watching well-produced specials with interviews and good graphics and on how a polar shift might occur, this is the number one movie out there. If you want to get your hands on it, all you really have to do is click the Horizon Project link at X Squared Radio. It'll take you right there. The reason I'm bringing this up is we're getting ready to start on part two, the next in the series. If you have watched The Kill Shot, you definitely need to see The Horizon Project. It'll definitely open your eyes and get you ready for stuff, and you might just sell that beachfront property. Hard to tell. You might be one of those kind of people that if you can't have your beachfront property and your slip and your boat, you don't want to be around. Some of the rest of us would rather watch that on the news and survive that initial event. Pick up the Horizon Project, give it a look, share it with some friends. I also wanted to give you an update on another film. Many of you, hundreds of you, have been writing me about One Anunnaki. It's the movie written and directed by John Greff, filmed by Florida Effects. It is an independent film, filmed digitally. The digital special effects and digital backdrops are going to be breathtaking. I wanted to give you an update about this film. The director has contacted me and let me know that the film is finished. It is only going through music scoring right now. Those of you in the filmmaking business know that's about the final step. It won't be long now. The independent film that's going to raise the bar for all other independent films, not just science fiction, but all films, is getting ready to come out. Be ready. One Anunnaki. The link is on our website at x2-radio.com, or you can go to Anunnaki.com. Do a search for it. If you can't find the website, click on the link at X Squared Radio. We'll take you right there. We're going to have John Gress back on the program in a few weeks, and he's going to give an update as to how the movie's coming. Now, you might be really intuitive, but it doesn't take too much intelligence to see that One Anunnaki is going to be followed by Two Anunnaki. In fact, it's the first in a trilogy. Now, this first movie is designed to set the stage. It tells the Zacharias Sitchin view of a master race, or at least a superior race, headed by two people, Enlil and Enki, who come to this planet and do some genetic intervention on this planet. They're going to tell the story in this first movie of the return of the Anunnaki to Earth, modern Earth. You're going to love it. This is going to be a great movie, and it's going to be, it's going to set all kinds of records for independent films. But movie number two is going to be epic in scope. It is going to begin in Edinburgh, Scotland. And from there, my friends, I can only tell you that, it's going to leave Star Wars and Star Trek in the dust, because this story is true. In this hour, we're going to talk a little bit about the physics of the soul. Many of you have come to the workshops that we've put on around the country called The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel. Well, this is what it's about. The physics of the soul is kind of an interesting concept. I want to try in 1 hour, well, actually about 40 minutes, we're going to lay the groundwork for this. And hopefully in 1 hour, those of you that are listening at your computer while you're at work, or if you're driving around the country right now, you'll be able to listen in and understand what this is all about. The soul is somewhat controversial, even among religious people. It is, some people say, a mixture of spirit and body, of an intelligence that is ageless, timeless, has always existed and always will exist, and it is having a mortal experience on this earth. Now, there are others that say the soul is just an intelligence that occupies this body. It is created at the time it is born, and it disappears forever at the time of death. I think that's a pretty small minority now. There are others still that believe the soul is made up of a spirit that is eternal, and it has one mortal experience after another, after another, after another, and it gains even more experience. It has more loves, it has more disappointments, it has more challenges, and it is ever in a state of perfecting, growing in maturity and wisdom with each time it becomes mortal. All of those are supported by the idea that there is physics behind the soul. In 1799, there was a young scientist whose name was Thomas Young, and he initiated his medical practice in London. His primary interest was in studying sensory perception. And now what I mean by that is with the senses of the body, hearing and smelling and eyesight and things like that. Now, in those days, you couldn't really do experimental surgery on live people, so they did experiments on cadavers. And so the sense that really fascinated Thomas Young was eyesight. Okay? He became fascinated with the function of the human eye. He took apart thousands of them, and he discovered the cause of astigmatism in 1801, which is about the time he began studying light. In 1801, Young performed an experiment, actually a series of experiments, with light pattern interference. He observed that when light from a single source, like a flashlight or a candle, is beamed or separated into two beams by sending them through two slits in a black piece of paper, and the two beams are then recombined, that is to say, the light that goes through those slits are allowed to re-expand and combine again and hit a screen, it produces a pattern of light and dark fringes. Young concluded that these fringes were the result of beams of light behaving as waves, with their peaks and troughs either constructively or destructively interfering with each other. You'll remember in our first hour we talked about constructive interference being like two chords on a piano playing together, thus being loud and more pleasing to the ear. And destructive chords are the dissident ones, the sour chords that sort of fight each other and diminish in sound. This is what we're talking about. As these waves come together, trough upon trough, they make a light spot. Trough upon valley, or trough upon peak, they create a dark spot. And so what became apparent in Young's conclusion was that different light waves interacted with one another in and out of phase to either annihilate one another to darkness or add to one another for greater brightness. When these two energy signals come together, they either constructively interfere with each other, thus adding to their power, or they destructively interfere with each other, causing a cancellation of the signals, or a dark spot. The dark fringes are a visual version of what noise cancellation headphones do for room noise. If you own a pair of noise cancellation headphones, this is what happens. The small microphones on the outside of the headphones pick up the room noise, the noise you normally hear when the noise cancellation power is off. When you turn the power on, it grabs the noise through these little microphones, shifts it out of phase 90 degrees, and then mixes it back with the sound that's coming over the headphones, the music that you're listening to. So the tiny amplifier inside the headphones makes an equal and opposite sound from the room noise. and it plays it along with the music you want to hear. The result is the room noise is magically reduced to almost nothing because the two opposite sounds cancel one another out. That's why it's called noise cancellation technology. Oh, that we could have small microphones that pick up the tiny positive energies around us and collect them into a large and mighty signal, amplify them and put them into our soul. I think Dr. Jim Bell has one of those little reflectors that you wear around your neck. It grabs the positive energies of the universe in the right frequencies and combines them constructively right there in front of you. It resonates with a jewel in the center of this unit, and then it resonates with your body. So these have been seen to work. In the future, we may have seen that many people bringing their positive energies together have a mighty effect, even on the very structure of matter itself. Whether it's water, tissue cultures, or the health of a human being, the constructive interference of a positive signal, even if it's generated by human beings, has a great effect for good. Likewise, collecting and echoing the negatives in the world have also the expected effect. The suggestion is, for me anyway, here at X Squared Radio, is that you turn the news off. Do not let their need for ratings perpetuate and breed the negative energy that tears down all the good done in the world. The dark fringes in Jung's double-slit experiment are not the source from which to draw happiness. All I'm saying is every 30 minutes or so, MSNBC repeats the bad news over and over and over again. And it's just like Tesla's technology, tapping the Boston Bridge at the right moment over and over and over again, except that this effect is negative. We don't want this negative energy. So what we need to do is stop the resonance of it by turning it off. Turn the news off, and that will turn off the negative resonance that's ripping our planet apart. Now, let's talk a little bit about atomic memories that are laid into us at birth and added to as we consume matter for food and as our cells are replaced with new matter from that food. That matter may contain particles that are entangled with sister particles possibly created by the same ancient supernova. When we talk about the creation of the universe, many of the things that happen in our universe are spontaneous, sudden, and very high energy. One of those things is a supernova. A supernova is a very special event in the death of a star. Now, these very large stars, 4 or 5 times the size of our star, is about the smallest one that we have observed, and they go much larger than that, but they're not smaller than our sun. Mathematically, they have to be at least 1.4 times the size of our sun in order to participate in this life cycle. Our sun's too small to do this, but most suns are larger than ours, and so they do go through this kind of life cycle. Excuse me. A little drink of water there. The life cycle is not why we see it burning brightly. Why we see it burning brightly, the hydrogen is fusing nicely together into helium, producing a vast array of light energy, not just UV, but also way up in the longer wavelengths in the red and infrared, warms planets nicely and makes it where we can read our newspapers in the noonday sun. As that hydrogen fuel wears out, in other words, it's all turning into helium, the sun loses its explosive force. The sun is actually a balancing act between its desire to explode into a gazillion bits out into space and the gravity that holds it together as a body. Well, as the fuel runs out, gravity begins to win the battle, and the sun begins to shrink. It begins to cool. Now, it goes through a couple of seemingly strange cycles. One is that it turns into a red giant. That is to say, it instead of burning nice and bright and white, it begins to cool and turn red, and it turns into a red giant, and as it expands, it can actually consume the planets that are close to it. But as it continues to cool, gravity takes over. It begins to crush back down, smaller and smaller in size. And with all that mass jammed into a smaller and smaller space, gravity becomes more and more intense. And it becomes so intense, in fact, that the electrons that once happily clouded around the outside of the nucleus of the helium can no longer stay in orbit around that molecule. So the two protons that make up helium are a positive charge, and the electrons are a negative charge floating around the outside. At some point, the electrons begin to get sucked down onto the protons, and they neutralize the protons into neutrons. So the helium molecule becomes four neutrons instead of two protons and two neutrons. Now, at first, this happens one or two atoms at a time, and then 1 or 2 billion and 1 or 2 trillion. But at some point, a real sudden point, all the electrons in the entire sun drop into the protons. Well, the concussion from that is called a supernova. It's a shock wave that's so powerful, it cleaves the atmosphere off that star. This huge, powerful energy pulse goes racing out into the solar system, turns all of those planets into pure energy, and goes racing off into the galaxy, destroying anything that it can. Of course, that energy is dissipating at the square of the distance because it's racing off in all directions, 360 degrees in every direction. So as the radius expands, the actual power delivered to any one point decreases by the square of that distance. But that very highly complex, very high energy goes racing out, changing all those planets into pure energy, and that pure energy produces higher order elements. Now, the interesting thing is it produces all these elements at pretty much the same instant. Now, something that is a little bit speculative, but has been noticed, is that matter that's created at the same time by the same event has a certain amount of entanglement. That is to say, the matter kind of knows each other. They're like sister particles and brother particles. What happens to one particle affects another particle. What happens to one piece of energy affects another piece of energy. These particles are like molecular transmitters, and they pick up messages from one particle to another. They act like molecular transmitters of intention across space and time. Sister particles may exist in other humans alive on the Earth now, and souls embodied on distant worlds now, or even as parts of other worlds now. The common thread is that these particles are entangled, and they're always in the now. There is no future or past to consider. Every effect, one way or the other, is exactly in the now. Now, it's not that a future or past don't exist. They do. It's just that these energies, like photons, are massless and exist independent of time. They may be multidimensional in nature, so that they are not limited or slowed down by a requirement to satisfy three-dimensional physics as we know it. Now, let me see if I can explain this. We have two beryllium ions in our experiment here, and these two beryllium ions have displayed behavior of entanglement. This means that I can pick a particle off of this beryllium ion over here, and I can set it over here in the corner of the room. I can take this other beryllium ion over here, and I can pick a particle off it and put it in an opposite corner of the room. These particles are spinning. Let's say one is spinning at a plus one-half, and the other is spinning at a minus one-half. I can electromagnetically switch the spin of this one over here from plus one-half to minus one-half. Guess what happens to the one in the other corner of the room? You guessed it. It switches spin instantaneously. Now, we don't know why it does this, but we do know that it's repeatable. It's been repeated many, many times in many labs by many people. But in 1999, a woman separated two particles, not by a room, but by 11 kilometers. 11 kilometers. Let me tell you something, folks. On a molecular level, it might as well be on the other side of the universe. She switched the spin of one particle, and instantaneously, 11 kilometers away, the other particle switched spin exactly on time. Now, this has remarkable implications, because we may not be talking about two beryllium ions anymore. We may be talking about a mineral in the earth. And the earth is created by matter made from an ancient supernova. And this earth, this ground, this dirt in which we grow plants, may have literal oceans of entangled particles. And those entangled particles are being consumed by plant life. Let's say, in this case, two ordinary carrots. One produced outside of Moscow, one produced outside of San Jose, California. The minerals go into the carrots. The carrots go into the grocery. They go from the grocery into an ordinary home. They get peeled a little bit back to get the dirt and the outside part of the carrot off. They're juiced, and then they're drunk. One in San Jose, one in Moscow. Or let's just say they eat the carrot raw. Well, the carrot goes into the gut of the two people. It gets digested. The minerals get absorbed by the body, placed where they're supposed to be placed, either with an enzyme or in the bones or in the muscles, somewhere in the body. And guess what? Those two bodies now have entangled particles in each one of them. That means that if one person in Moscow decides to have a thought, to have an intention that affects their body, that affects the particles in that body, then instantaneously the particles in the other body, in San Jose, are affected. Now that means that the intention, the mood, the energy, the vibrational level of the person in Moscow affects matter that exists in another person in San Jose, and vice versa. Now, we're talking about the biochemistry, the physics of these two souls. These two souls occupy physical bodies which contain entangled particles on the same planet. The intention of one person affects matter in the other person. What might you say are the ramifications of this? Well, we have about 25 minutes left. I'd like you to call and give me what you think might be the ramifications of this. Toll free anywhere in the U.S., 877-270-8714. Anywhere else on the planet, and if you've got free long distance, you have no reason not to call in, 530-413-4515. All right, here we go. Energy is normally raw and chaotic. It tends to wind down like a clock. As energy moves away from its point of release, emanating in all directions like a sphere at once, we calculate, as I said, the rate of about a square of the distance. In other words, let's say that you were standing in the middle of a football field and someone was at the 5-yard line and they decided to set off a firecracker. Well, you would hear that firecracker. But let's say you move to the other side of the field 100 yards away and they lit the same firecracker. The sound would be somewhat quieter, wouldn't it? In fact, you might say that it wouldn't be too hard to find a distance at which you couldn't hear the firecracker at all. That's because the energy packet, called a quanta, is emanating in all directions at once. And the odds of that energy reaching the tympanic membrane of your ear as you get further and further away drop by the square of the distance. So, this supernova event does the same thing. It sends out energy into the universe that way. It affects the planets closest to it more than it does the planets further away. And that's how it goes. That's how these entangled particles are created. Is it possible that you are entangled, or the matter that makes up your body is entangled with a body on a distant world? Yes, it's possible, especially if the supernova is the same distance from that world as it is from this world. So now you think about it, this incredible influx of new technology that's hitting the Earth right now, and it's interesting as I travel around and go from lab to lab and talk to inventor, I see great similarities in their ideas. Well, they might have received it a little bit different. An electrical engineer is going to receive it a little bit different than a mechanical engineer, but they're still receiving the same shapes, the same sacred geometry, the same idea of spinning this or tweaking that or magnetizing this or electrifying that. And sure enough, sooner or later, the technology is going to come out, and we're going to know about it, and we're going to see it happen. The same thing happens the other way. When we talk about human intention, we talk about human will, there are a couple sides to the coin. Some people seem to think that human will is a bad thing, that we should relinquish it. We should just turn everything over to God, and he will control everything. Well, folks, the reality is that God controls nothing. In fact, he cannot control anything. If he controlled the universe, not only would he cease to be God, but the universe would completely disappear. And designing it and setting it up is one thing. Controlling it, that's another completely. He has to leave things to freedom of choice. He has to leave things alone. He has to let us make up our own minds. He can inspire. He can lead us by the still small voice. He can give us positive feedback for one thing and negative feedback for another thing. You can have joy. You can have sadness. You can have happiness. You can have despair. All of these are feedback mechanisms from the universe, all driven by the law of attraction. So the intention that we have, the thoughts we have, the energy, and thus the particles that we have, are entangled across the universe. Now, what affects a particle in one part of the universe also affects a sister particle in another part of the universe, even across parsecs of time. So the energy that we generate, the energy that we are as a soul, as a spirit, it can have one of two effects. We can either sit back and be affected by the universe, and trust me, the universe is affecting us. Or we can turn around and use our intention and we can affect the universe. You get that? You're either acted upon or you act upon the universe. Both have their effect. If you're asleep and you're not awake and you're not conscious, but you're making decisions every day, you are affecting the universe. Whether you like it or not, you are affecting the universe. It's called the observation effect. Whether you observe something in a positive way or a negative way has an effect on the universe. Whether you send out fear, whether you send out love, has an effect on the universe. Now, fear, as you've heard on this program before, by many accounts, is far more powerful of a creator than love is. You will create the condition of your own life through your own fears much better than you will through your loves. I shouldn't say much better. How about much more powerfully, much more easier? The things that you fear will manifest in your life a lot easier than the things that you love. That means that you're going to have to love a lot harder than you're afraid. You're going to have to love a lot harder than you fear in order to make things move. And when the bottom line is, it doesn't really matter how much people love you. What really matters is how you love other people. And if you go back and listen to the master teachers, even one like Jesus Christ, you'll hear him say the same thing exactly. Love yourself, love your neighbor, everything else falls into place. So the cells in your body are made up of this matter that's entangled with matter in other bodies. As you love yourself, you're changing the vibration of those, of the matter in those cells. As you change the vibration in those cells, you change the vibration in other cells as well. That means the more you love yourself, the more loved other people will feel around you. Now, what does this have to do with physics? It does. We say you are what you eat, and we mean it. Even more, it means that over time, we may accumulate a new set of sensors in the body that pick up the energy fields generated by the human itself. These fields are not so much made by the physical body. Instead, they are directed and formed through the conscious intent of the spirit that makes up the human intelligence. These energies are transferred into the energy of the particles and the energies that are entangled. And then these particles and energies have instantaneous effects on other energies and particles, not just through your own neighborhood, but throughout the universe, that may have been created simultaneously from the same supernova event that we talked about. So when we say that everything you do will eventually affect the universe, that is exactly what is happening. There's a simple experiment that you can do. If you own an acoustic guitar, you can do this. Just take it out of the case and lean it up against the wall with the strings facing out. Then, select a radio station on your stereo system, or put some music on a CD or your iPod. Pick something with a broad range of sound like drums or synthesizer music or strings, and then turn up the volume. As you're listening, without warning, somewhere in that song, one of the strings on that guitar will ring out as if someone had plucked it with a pick. Now that's a fact, and you can try it yourself. Here's what actually happened. In reality, some certain frequency in the music resonated with that guitar string. In actuality, the string absorbed that exact frequency out of the music in the room. This sympathetic energy transfer is how each of us affects the universe. It is also how all information is moved through all dimensions, regardless of time. This means you, yourself, your intention, your soul, is the same as the music source. The universe is the guitar, only it has almost an infinite number of strings. It has bad strings, it has good strings, it has dark strings, and it has light strings. It has love strings, and it has fear strings. So you pick the music that you're going to emanate into the universe. You pick it. You choose it. It's not chosen for you. Pick the music that you're going to resonate. One of the master teachers also said, let your light so shine. Don't put your light under a bushel, but let it shine so others can see it. The only thing you have to make a decision of, my friends, my fellow Earth explorers, is what is the frequency of the light that you will shine out? Will it be a broad range of frequencies, or will it be focused like a laser? Will it have several colors in it, or will it be a single wavelength directed at a single idea? The next thing you have to decide is how bright you want that light to shine. Do you want one candle power, or do you want 10 billion candle powers? You decide the intensity and the color of your own light, the intensity and the wavelength of your own music. Now, once that music is broadcast out into the universe, the strings that are in tune, that are in harmonic tune with the energy that you put out, will begin resonating. They'll begin vibrating. And when they vibrate, they send out a sympathetic resonance to the rest of the universe. And what comes back to you is not what you sent out. What comes back to you is are the fruits of what you sent out. You know, even God says that he sends rain to the earth. He doesn't expect to get rain back. He expects to get the fruits from the rain. This is the way the scriptures kind of write to us and say that what we want back is the result of what you are sending out. Now, my friends, you are sending out all the time. whether you're conscious of it or whether you're unconscious of it. And what a tragedy it is. A tragedy that there are millions of people in our country and other countries that send out this information, send out this resonance, send out this energy completely asleep. They don't have a clue that they're affecting the universe. The negativity, the fear, the cynicism, the jealousy, the prejudice that they send out in the universe by their thoughts alone affect the universe. They march us as surely toward Armageddon as though we had no choice but to follow the script itself. What I'm trying to tell you tonight in this final hour here on X Squared Radio is that you can immediately choose a different path, and not just for yourself. You can choose a different path for everyone. Every single time you send a fearful signal out into the universe, it resonates with all the fearful strings. If you send out a hate message, a prejudice message, a cynical message, a fearful message, it resonates with all of those very strings in the universe, and that's what gets generated. But if you send out a message of conscious love, and I don't mean just I want to love everybody, I mean, if you're out there and you have an idea for a song, a poem, a home design, an energy device, a book, a way of teaching, a way of treating another person that's positive and loving and open and considering and grateful, the fruits from that will be felt across the universe. The choice is yours. Now, you might think of this task as being too daunting, as saying, oh my gosh, I can't look at an eternity of doing that. I've got to be afraid. I have to wonder where my next paycheck is coming from. I have to worry about whether I'm going to have enough to pay my bills or send my kids to college, or whether I'm going to get over this illness, or whether I'm going to graduate school, or whether my car is going to make it the next mile. I've got to worry about that. I'm telling you, my friends, you do not. You do not have to worry about that. Don't think about it in terms of eternity. You know how long eternity is? Eternity is only one more moment. That's it. One more moment. And then another. And then another. Don't even think of it in terms of hours or minutes or seconds. Just think of it in terms of moments. If you can manage a positive thought, if you can manage love and tune fear out of your life for one moment, you can do it forever.
We have a caller on line four.
So let's talk to our caller who is on the line. Can you tell us your first name and where you're calling from?
I'm Jeannie in Arkansas.
Well, hi. Welcome from Arkansas.
It's a pleasure to talk with you.
The pleasure's all mine. Go ahead.
Well, I spent 3 hours listening, and I make sure to tune in to you. I'm fascinated with what you say and the clarity with which you speak it. And just wanted to let you know, I hate to interrupt what you're saying, so I haven't ever called, but I just wanted you to know how much your program does resonate out.
Oh, I can't tell you how much I appreciate that.
I'm kind of at a loss for words myself right now.
I had just
recently gotten the book Entangled Minds by Dean Radin, so I was very interested in what you were talking about in that respect as well. And as you were speaking, I do understand how things go out and come back and resonate across everywhere. And it came to me, the picture of a boomerang. If you're not careful when you throw that out, it comes back so fully loaded. If you're not careful, it can hit you in the head. And kind of
when you're not looking.
Better be a little careful and watch what's coming back, too.
Oh, I appreciate your telephone call so much. And I have to tell you, you are exactly the reason why I am still on the radio. We're going into our third year now, and I'm amazed at the authors that have sent me books and that we've read and we talk about here. Some of them come on the radio all the time. Different programs are out there, and some have never been on the radio. But we try to do something a little bit different here. We do our very best to try to put out a clear thought and not run everywhere. But gosh, we got to talk about new technology, and we got to talk about where it's taking us and what it means to us. And hearing your feedback is just tremendously valuable to me.
Well, all of it is extremely fascinating, interesting, and I think you're right on target. I would like to be going in space myself. I would really love to go with you on the inner Earth exploration. I firmly believe that there's people in so many other places. Haven't really thought about the inner Earth of Mars, but that makes sense, too. And I have had experiences with extraterrestrials, so I do.
Well, isn't that story fascinating about these openings into the crust of Mars?
Right. I was trying to remember the NASA guy that did the Mars tapes some time back on the face of Mars. And the
that was Richard Hoagland.
Hoagland, yeah.
Yeah.
I have a friend with a similar name, and I always try to get the other name first. But his work was fascinating, is fascinating as well. William Henry, all of you guys, you're marvelous. And I've just recently discovered BBS and so many new people and so many new avenues of thought. And
I appreciate it so much.
Doing.
We've had a great time the last 12 months. We've done 13 cities and got to meet Richard Hoagland. And, of course, we're good friends with William Henry. We're going to be going to Egypt with him in January. And we're going to shoot part two of the Inner Earth Expedition while we're there and try to get it out next spring as quickly as we can.
That was exciting to hear, too.
Yeah, it's going to be fascinating. We're taking 20 people, 20 key people with us, and hopefully we'll discover something. We're actually going to be doing an experiment while we're there that's never been tried before.
I've heard you guys allude to that.
Well, I'm going to bring
What's
my equipment
be?
With me, and where we have a telephone line, we'll have broadcast. So we'll broadcast from Egypt if it's possible.
Cool.
Yeah, it's all very
you can't
cool.
really say what the experiment is yet, can you?
What is?
The experiment
I can tell you the experiment's electromagnetic, but I can't tell you anything else about it. I don't want to set up any opposition to it. But it has something to do with a device called the OSIRIS device.
Okay. Cool.
So you might want to put that into your Google, do a search on it, and it'll take you directly to William Henry, who is
exactly.
the discoverer of the OSIRIS device.
I'm familiar with that.
And we're going to do something that's never been done before. Well, it probably hasn't been done since ancient Egyptian times. No, we're not going to sacrifice anybody. We're going to try something electromagnetic and just see what kind of results we get, and we're going to film it while it happens, just to see.
I predict some amazing results.
Well, maybe so, and we're going to take a more advanced form of this experiment to the North Pole with us, and we're going to be performing this
really
experiment.
I'm just really envious of that one too.
Yeah.
My thoughts and. Good wishes and everything go with you on both of the adventures. I think I'm so glad someone is doing that. I wish I could be part of it, but it's just
you can be part of it.
But it's being done.
Have you sent an application
I'll go
in?
I'll along with you, kind of in the spirit form.
Everybody can be a part of history.
I'll be there.
Do you own a copy of the Inner Earth Expedition video?
No, I do not yet.
Well, what you need to do, go ahead and email me. I know you're from Arkansas. Just tell me you're the caller from Arkansas. Send me an email, and I'll send you the DVD for the Inner Earth Expedition. It's kind of Hollow Earth for Dummies, but it has a lot of exclusive footage from Tibet And
oh, I love that.
Many people that have seen it really like it, and maybe you can talk some of your friends into actually buying one. But then you can become a part of history.
I can do that.
All right, just send me an email.
I definitely will do that.
BAgnew@x2-radio.com and request one. Give me your address, and I'll send it out to you.
I will do that.
Excellent, excellent.
God bless you for what you're doing. It's awesome.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for calling in.
I'm going to go back to listening to you now. Take care. God bless.
Well, tell all your friends in Arkansas. We'll build our listenership in that state, too.
We can do it. Oh, and I've got my brother in California tuning in to you, too.
Oh, really? Where does your brother live?
He's in West Covina.
Well,
out of LA.
I was just in West Covina. No, I'm going to be back
there. Really?
Yeah.
Wow. A day late for us to find out.
Yeah, we just drove through there. On our way to Bakersfield.
Wow. I will tell him.
Well, very good. Yeah, we're doing great things out there,
too. He'll flag you down.
Yeah. Well, I'm the world's easiest person to find, except for the men in black. I don't know if they can figure out where I am. I'm so scattered when I travel. I don't think anybody would ever be able to follow me.
Oh, well, okay then.
I always make a lot of jokes about that I make so many mistakes in following maps and things, and I'm constantly turning around to go back to things that I've passed up, that if anybody was following me, they probably would go back to their higher-ups and say, oh, this guy's good, he's really good. More
like
Dumb and Dumber, I think.
Encounter trying to follow a map one time, and I won't go into that now, but it was quite interesting.
That is so funny.
You made me remember that when you said that. Heck, we were getting lost, and the map wasn't helping, and 9 hours later, we figured out why. Anyway, I'll let you go. It's terrific talking with you, and it's such a pleasure to know that you're out there.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, put this number on speed dial. Call back in again, another show.
Oh, I will. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So, my friends, we have come to... I can't believe 3 hours has gone. I didn't even get a chance to talk to you about this other thing. That's all right. We'll put it into the next program. We are coming up on the end of our program. Got about 2 minutes left. If there's another caller out there, we can fit you in. I did want to let you know that these effects that we have on the universe can be read about, learned about. This has not been an infomercial, but if you want to learn more about the physics of the soul and time travel, next month, Author House Publishers is going to be releasing our third book, which is called Unlocking the Secret. And it is the final book in the trilogy of the Arc of Millions of Years. It is over 400 pages long. If you love pictures, you're going to love this book because it's got a lot of pictures in it. It is a two-part book. The first part covers the last part of the 2012 prophecies, are following those all the way to their end, and the second part is called Unlocking the Secret, where we talk about the physics of the soul, time travel. We go well into entangled particle theory in a very layman way so that you can understand it. It's interesting. You'll understand how the universe is made and how we have an effect on it, and that you, each one of you, are creators in your own right. Once you realize that and you're empowered to do that, we want you to choose to do it positively. Spread the power that you have inside each one of you, and believe me, your power and your energy and your ability is absolutely unlimited. I don't care how old you are. If you're 50 or if you're 100 or if you're 15, you can affect the universe in a very powerful way. We want you to let you know here at X Squared Radio, you are source. Everything you do can and does affect the universe. So So try to do it on purpose. Look for the good in people every day and help it to grow a little. And before too long, you will have saved the planet. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio saying peace, Earth Explorers. Good night.